Right, I will start, because I sent a prattle on. My usual lecture is about an hour and a half, so I'll have to cut a lot out and a lot short. And I've got a longer version of what that happened here. If I can find the right thing. Let me start off by saying that the title, In Search of Phantom Fortunes, intrigued me. It was reading through Seaborn Rowntree's Poverty and Progress, 1956, published in 1941, that you actually look at him dealing with gambling. And he suggested that the working class were in search of phantom fortunes. I don't think the working class were ever in search of phantom fortunes. They knew it would be a small winnings, but at least it was something. And that really sort of touched a nerve, because when I started, an interest in gambling, I suppose, I was a bright young lad. I was born in 1946, so I'm obviously 21. At 1958, I was 12 years of age. I used to take bets from my mother to the local bookie. And he said, hey, you're a bright lad. Would you like to run for me on a Saturday? So that's exactly what I did. What I did was to go to 40 houses, gather the money in, because it would be mad, it's illegal at that time. And then hopefully not go to 40 houses later on, because that means you're paying out. And if we more money we got, the better was my 10 or 12 bob or 15 bob I could get on a Saturday. That was good money. I'm going to say, I was 12 years of age, 8 of the houses I went to were houses of policemen. So you've got to remember straight away that, you know, it was something that was accepted. It was endemic, was gambling. 70 or 80% of people did it. The policeman did it. The policeman that was raiding the bookie on a Monday may well be putting a bet up with him on the Tuesday. I mean, I've got lots of examples of that sort of thing. Now, I'm going to say that early that meant I didn't have to do a paper round. It meant, a better life. I mean, I did get some money by going to Bon Breton in Barnsley, the cricket club. It's the ground's like that. So people used to drop 2 and 6s out of their pocket, and I could get up to 8 bob, 10 bob. But I just go around the ground at the end of a match. So I had all the sort of techniques. And I did put my first bet up to 2 and 6, would you believe, on the nose in the Grand National. 8 to 1, Mr. Watt. I remember that pound came in very well indeed. Well, one of the things I would suggest, going back to Rowntree, is that in fact, you know, he was horrified that the working class had spent their money on gambling. I mean, came from New York, he was aware that the working classes went here. The working class of York only went to York. They didn't go to the other meetings, there's a lot of middle class people there. The tourists are the middle class, not the working class. And he set up a National Anti-Gambling League in 1890. And it was very much dominated by the Quakers. Think about that, the Quakers. You've got the church organisations, you've got the Society of Friends and Churches Committee on Gambling. Most of the churches are somewhere involved in trying to restrict gambling. But if you have ever studied gambling and churches, nonconformists hate it. I was talking to one yesterday. I'm telling you all about it because I can use that argument in my meeting tomorrow or something. And the Church of England tolerate it. If they can afford it, that's fine. And then Catholics are rampant. You look at bingo, which was illegal because it was a lottery. With cash, it was illegal because it's a lottery. A lottery is a game of chance. So until 1960, bingo, if you paid for money, it was illegal. Played for a prize, if you played under certain conditions, but if you paid money, by and large, it was illegal, and I'll see that later on. So really, in a sense, you know, if you go to Huddersfield, 1958, 59, 60, look at the courts, records that have been in the paper. Every week, there's a Catholic priest in court. He's playing Kenko bingo within his congregation. And Kenko will pay the fine, except for one who insists that he will not pay the fine and goes even further. It is endemic to society. National Anti-Gambling League didn't like it. But they had 3 objections to it. One is that it would create poverty, which I don't think is true, but still, that it created poverty. It's a waste of money. Secondly, it corrupted women and children. And thirdly, if you won the money, it created a sort of something for nothing type of culture. Those were its 3 major arguments. It was loathsome to them, and certainly we'll come back to that in a few minutes. Neil Rowntree was very aware that working class gambling was small scale. All he had to do was look at the postal orders in the 1930s. What were the postal orders in July or August and comparing to the postal orders in September, October, November, the football season? And you'll find the difference tells you how many people, because you can do a 6-week postal order, haven't you? Well, he was horrified at that. Now, against that, I mean, he found that about 12,000 people were spending money extra on football tours in the football season. Against this viewpoint, that it's a waste of money, is the viewpoint put forward by quite a number of historians. Tom Shin wrote a book called Better Betting with a Decent Fella. Now, his father was a bookie before he became professor of social history at Birmingham University. Better Betting with a Decent Fella. It's got a brilliant book, actually, called About Money. It's called the, something like They Stand Their Ground, or something, I can't remember the title now. But it's about the women of Britain. Actually, it's about the women of England. It's actually about the women of Birmingham. Actually, it's about the women of the Chin family. And it's a superb book about life and culture. He's done that sort of thing. But what he was concerned about is the seedy image presented of bookies and the whole culture of working class going to bookies to put their money on. The seedy image of Grundy, the reprehensible backyard bookie, who goes up with Sal Hardcastle after Larry Reed's death in Walter Greenwood's Love on the Dove, if you've ever read that. If you haven't looked at, was it Bergerac and everything, they're always seedy at these bookies, aren't they? They're dodgy. There's a rather nice introduction to his book by Graham Sharp, of William Hills. Graham Sharp started off as a journalist, then became a bookmaker. His mother said, from disreputable hack to unscrupulous bookie, all you need now is to become an estate agent and you've completed the unholy trinity. It's not bad. So there's some sort of, what he's trying to do is to adjust that sort of viewpoint, and people like Mark Clapson, Ross McKibben and others have come to the viewpoint it's actually quite small scale is gambling amongst the working class up to the 1960s. So there's three questions I'm really beginning to look at. One is, was gambling affordable? Brief on that, but secondly, why did the National Anti-Gambling League help to create or put forward new legislation, particularly the 1906 Street Betting Act, the shortest piece of legislation I've ever seen? It's that long. Yeah. And all it says is street betting is illegal. This is the first fine, a guinea fine. Third time you get 3 months hard labour. And that's it. Yeah, it's pretty desperate. I've never seen an act of Parliament as short as that. It took a long time to get it into place. So. The third question is, why must this blatant piece of class legislation, which it was, and I'll explain why, the epitome of class legislation, why did it take another 50-odd years for it to be removed? One thing I will stress too, I'll argue here, is that working class gambling was small scale, manageable mainly within the family budget. Secondly, it was the undue influence of a small group of people on Parliament, the House of Lords, etc., the churches, that got legislation like the 1906 and a bunch of other pieces later on in place to stop working classes having free access. And thirdly, what I would argue is that very quickly the police didn't want it. I mean, it's gambling is immoral, but it's not criminal. Why should we be wasting all that time? You'll find police spending 48,000 hours, I think, the police force spent in 1 year, to arrest 200 people to put one in prison. And all it does is bugger up the relationships between the police and the public. Why? But it's still, despite that, it took another 50 years, and I think there's a lot of factors, like the Labour Party being very anti-gambling, the Labour leaders leading the working class are very anti-gambling, Nye Bevan always voted against that. Ramsay MacDonald wrote a book for the National Anti-Gambling League, etc. But it's also other factors like the emergence of so many alternative forms of gambling, where you could get people on the course, for instance, greyhound racing. Get them on the course, it's legal. On course, gambling is legal. Off course, is illegal, unless it's credit. Yeah. And who has access to credit? People with bank accounts and phones. They can phone up their bookings, they've got a pound on Queen's horse. And then the same person, the magistrate, can put you down for ready money gambling. You know, fine, you and if you've done it three times and be caught three times, you're in prison. You know, hypocrisy. Anyway, so it's that sort of argument we're going to use. One thing I should say a little bit about is gambling itself. I haven't put much down there. Working class gambling is pretty obvious. There's two or three forms. And one major form, of course, is basically going to a house to put a bet on, betting house, illegal after 1853 until 1961. Or people in the street gambling. And putting money on horses, usually, but sometimes greyhounds, but whatever. And of course, if you're developing that sort of gambling, if you're in a house, then it's useful to have a house as a fish and chip shop or a shop. Because if people could constantly go into a house that, you know, is not something where people should be constantly going in, the police will draw attention, they'll put two policemen on it, watch it for 48 hours, and then if they decide it's a gambling house, they raid. So that's what they do. And you know, Carl Chinn has a lot of material. He did a tremendous survey of interviewing bookies in the 1980s. You know, the fish and chip shops, a lot of women were bookies. They were often better at it than men, actually. Every bookie, apparently, 120 of them, everyone interviewed was a social worker. You know, they stopped people spending too much, they looked after them, they went into a pub and thing. But they had one question that none of them can remember. They have collective amnesia. They can't remember how much they took. A remarkable feature. Now, Carl Chinn's written superbly on that. But that's one form of gambling. But there's other forms. There's cranking, bowling. There's darts from the 1920s and 1927 onwards, where you get the world, use of the world darts championships. Sid Waddell wasn't there. I mean, Sid Waddell is my big friend. I mean, I'm the bad professor. If he ever talked to him in darts, I don't watch darts boring. But gambling straight away from 1927 onwards. Cranking, bowling. In terms of sort of sports and gambling activity itself, one of the things people forget is pitch and toss. You know, the idea is you pitch to a point, and whoever gets nearest becomes the bookie. Invariably, it's bookies. And then you get people in a sort of semi-circle around, and you get somebody to pitch two coins. And if they come down two heads, bookies won, two tails, if the punters have won, and if it's one and one, you have to toss again. The best tossing school was in Queensbury, in Yorkshire. They had a chap called Bump Roller, a bookie with a big bouncer with him, you know. Because, you know, like people, one of the things you can do is you can just go like that in drops. So you've got to do a proper toss. And on one occasion, Bump Rose, he said, if you challenge it again, there's a little 5-foot weasel, challenge him, said, no toss, no toss. He said, you do that again, I'll thump you. Well, he threatened, he did it again, and the bloke threatened to thump him. He forgot that the man he was challenging was 5-foot bantamweight champion of Yorkshire. And he flattened his 6-foot And there's lots of other stories, isn't there? These are part and parcel of the culture. Gaming, I should say one quick word about gaming. One of the real problems in the 1820s, there was legislation 23-26 that stopped national lotteries or public lotteries. And we didn't get public lottery again until 1994. Now, public lottery is where you advertise it, it's not a restricted group, etc. You can have private lotteries, the City of London had private lotteries in the 1920s. 150,000 people, no advertising, could all take tickets out and win up to £2,000 prizes. That's private. No advertising and so forth. Well, one of the real problems is this private and public. It constantly worries the minds of Home Office and police because it's, if it's chance, say you're playing bingo, that's another thing I haven't talked about, but bingo, chance, or a card game, where it's really just a card coming over. That's chance. And if you're playing for money, it's illegal. But then, if you've got skill, your card game is a card game of skill, then it's legal. So, is partner whist skill or chance? It might not seem much to you, but the Home Office in the 20s and 30s tore its hair out about that. You know, one time it was, one time it wasn't, it kept changing the mind. There are problems with the legislation and how you deal with it. Let's move on to the first question, which is really about how endemic, widespread it was, but not so much that. Was it a bit of a flutter? Was gambling a bit of a flutter? Or was it a serious social problem? Now, nobody can agree to how much was spent on gambling. If you look at the EW Parsons, Methodist investor, the working class spend £500 million a year on gambling. Not a hint that they actually get some of it back. They lose it. And often that's the viewpoint. The House of Lords said it's about £100 million in 1901. 1933, there is a thing, I'd like to have his name slightly changed. There's a Royal Commission on Gambling. The man in charge of it, the chair, is a chap called Roulette. I'd love it if it was Roulette. It really would have made my day. I hope it's said that way, you know, but I'm not sure it was. A later survey, so the National Anti-Gambling League did a survey in 1947, they got mass observation, you come across that, have you? Mass observation, Tom Harrison, looking at social matters. And he got them to send, about 2,000 people out to interview, about 20,000 people. And they came up with a conclusion that it wasn't massive, and there wasn't much. So the National Anti-Gambling League wouldn't publish it, because it was against what they are. There's a Sherman report, well, Sherman's, which pointed out that most gambling was between about 300 and 500 millions, and the average bet of a working class person was two bob and sixpence, whereas the average middle class, I think it's 4 and 10, and the richer middle classes were 8 and 10, that sort of thing. In other words, you really don't know. You're spitting into the wind when you're trying to calculate that. I think that's the real problem. But most of the evidence, when it comes and when it's available, I mean, I could go through 20 surveys and tell you the results of them. I've got quite a good memory, so I can do it probably. But the end product is that they don't know how much gambling goes up. After all, a lot of it's illegal. And how do you measure it? And secondly, where there are attempts to measure it and surveys, they always indicate small, regular amounts. I mean, I've seen a sort of greyhound racing. Take £60 million from the pocket of the world. Rubbish. Whoever wrote that knows nothing about greyhound racing. After 1934, the tote has to pay 94% back, you know, it's a fund, has to pay 94% back to its punters. So the working class who are bet on that can only lose 6% on each race. They can't be losing all their money. It's impossible. It's not allowed, legally allowed. Some of your, I'll come back to that later on. So we don't know. Secondly, another question, subsidiary, and I haven't really time to go into it, is why do people gamble? And if you look at, there's a brilliant article, I don't think I put it down there, by Ross McKinney. And Ross McKinney has written one particularly good article. And what he comes up with, and I think many examples I come up with, is people gamble because they want some excitement from the drudgery of their lives. It's their chance to have one moment of easing tensions and so forth. And you've got that sort of viewpoint, really, I suppose, it emerges. Also, you're brought up with it. I mean, I've forgotten to say it at the right time, because I should have mentioned it earlier. But, for instance, in gaming, in the Second World War, the Blackpool Chief Constable hated gaming in Blackpool. And they arrested a chap called Mr. Burnett, a corporal in the RAF. "We're all fighting for freedom, but what kind of freedom is this? I was playing marbles at the age of 8. At 14, I was tossing pennies, a cruel offence. At 17, I entered to the army and started to play pontoon, and worse than that poker. All offences against the law. Yet a wealthy man can ring up a bookmaker, and have a bet on a horse. I hope that we are fighting for the day when we can have a game of cards when we want. You know, there are, you know, people felt that they had the right to, and he feels particularly indignant. He's still got fined. The magistrates in Blackpool were particularly unforgiving. So we need to look at that. But can I just move on to the second question now? And that's National Anti-Gambling League and gambling. Why and what did they do, and you know, why were they successful, for instance, in getting a street betting act of 1906 onto the statute? Already there was the 1853 one. Stop them backing in house and now stop them backing in the streets. As I said, it was formed in 1890. I'll not go through the details of it, but it did try to stop all betting. What it did was it got Newmarket, Tattersall's, declared to be a betting house. So all courses throughout the country, Tattersall's are going to be closed down. Kempton were very clever. They got their manager, whom they sacked, to sue them, effectively for wrongful dismissal. He won his case. So all the Tattersall's had to be opened again. They lost with the middle class, but they focused on the working class. And the sort of literature, if you've got it in your, look at the handout there, but there's a literature from the National Anti-Gambling League. I think it's page, bottom of page two. And this is a sort of typical sort of thing. You used to get converted gamblers, or points of that. He saw a ragged breech and urchin runner shrieking out all the winners, and the devil smiled and sniggered, what fun. What a bait for the green-fired sinners. Whilst the gambling demon is awake, half the imps might be idle snoozers, but wouldn't it sell if I published from hell my record of all the losers? Of all the primrose past, is the betting trade meets strangest to perdition. And the losses each day of their souls, I should say, would fill a big special edition. Really, it's really quite a dramatic, you know, hell unto hell, fire and damnation, if you gamble. It's an overt piece. What happens is 1890, National Anti-Gambling League purchased the street betting to be made illegal. It's an overt piece of class legislation when they introduce it. They struggle through the laws, I won't give you the details. But by 1906, having had the support of Lord Hereford, George Curzon, who was the father of the first wife of Oswald Mosley, and sometime possible leader of you know, practical leader of the Conservative Party at the time. I mean, George Curzon very simply said, yes, it's class legislation. We can afford it, the working class can't. That's pretty bloody, but what they say. And, you know, in 1906, the Act was passed, the Street Betting Act. Took it 4 years to do it, but they did it in the end. Dave Dixon said that he said quite clearly, created one law for the rich and one for the poor. The Society for the Suppression of Street Betting, that compulsory registration, they wanted registration, said it meant the harshest laws working men and non-indigents with the rich can afford no permanent solution of the gambling problem in a democratic country. And that's the point. The more democracy you get, people have the vote, you have to change. The Truth, yeah, I'm looking at you break down there, The Truth, a radical newspaper in 1938. The man of means can back his fancy with all the starting price officers if he is unable to get to the racecourse. But Alf, the tried and trusted, the bookies of the street, is harried by the police. It is a survival of the old Puritan hatred of gambling, and indeed pleasure in any form. But whereas a Puritan can stop the poor man from backing his fancy, he was impotent against the rich man and wanted to do the same. Jones, there's another beautiful one, I think you might have part of this in your handout there. The evils of gambling are only discovered when working men start gambling. Then it becomes a moral offence. I could go to Throgmorton Street tomorrow morning and see more responsible kind of gambling. Nobody thinks of going to street betting. This is a bit hypocrisy, Quakers, on the stock exchange, gambling. Isn't that gambling? Sorry. In some streets in my division, I can see detectives busy picking up an odd man here and there, taking betting slips. Other people can gamble with impunity. Those who put a shilling in a horse are heading to Dartmoor, but those who put thousands of pounds down are not gambling at all. They are acting in a businesslike way. The bill does not go far enough. I should like it to go. He's a man against gambling. a Labour MP against it. If gambling is wrong, why not deal with it properly on a whole scale, if you can get the words out, and let the gamblers go where they ought to go. That's hell. Most of them would not like the climate. There ought not to be one law for the rich and another for the poor, as the case is today. And there's other examples I can give you of that time. That's why I'm seeing gambling. He was quite successful in getting the Street Betting Act introduced. It actually did another success, the Ready Money Act connected with football clubs in 1920. A lot of newspapers had their football clubs, you six or eight or whatever. Now, you can't do it ready money. You can do it, and the clubs got at it. You can do it by the second week, people will pay. But papers don't have that, so people will put it in, expect to win, but won't pay if they don't follow me. It put an end, practically, to football pools in newspapers. But elsewhere, they're not terribly successful. And there's a lot of hypocrisy. Let me think about Seaborne Rantree and George Cadbury, two leading Quakers. They own, or they buy, the Northern Echo and the Star, two newspapers, who had a tipster called Captain Cook. And they get rid of it. Now, between 1906 and 1911, their sales fall to about 40% of what they previously were. They're worried their papers are going to collapse, so they reintroduce gambling or tipping. 1 o'clock edition has a lot of it. 3 o'clock, less. 5 o'clock, less. 7 o'clock edition, none. And they reinstate Captain Co. The Tory press have a field day. They call Captain Co. Captain Coco. You know, Big Cadbury and Rantree. Brilliant. So in a sense, you know, the National Anti-Gambling League was successful beyond its weight, really, I think, in most respects. Now, I said earlier on that police were very quickly against gambling. I've got the wrong name now, but it's Robert Peacock. Only one chief constable I came across actually said, yes, the gamblers in my patch, they're in prison, or whatever. Nearly every chief constable in the 1920s realised it's a waste of time with their forces. This is Sir Harold Scott, Commissioner of the Police in 1950, and he gives his evidence of a Royal Commission on Lotteries and Gaming. He said it was clear that Street Betting Act is a class legislation because persons of good status can bet with credit without breaking the law. It does nothing to improve the relations between the police and the public. Chief Constable Lester says the same. You know, this is designed to, it's designed to be with the immoral amongst one group of people, the working class. And the police, by and large, has to come to accommodation. In many areas, it's quite true when people say the police are in the heap of the book, yes, they are. They have to work the system. And I looked across a booklet in Salford Archives on policing. And it was a booklet of 51 names. And at four times a year, there was a guinea. I eventually worked it out that what it got is four times a year in this particular patch, street bookies were accosted and charged a fixed fee. It was a rate. It's just effectively, and becoming green attacking this, it was right, but the police had to come to some sort of accommodation, can't deal with it. And it was true, you could go to Williamson Square in Liverpool, Middleton in Leeds, where 2,000 or 3,000 people would gather per Saturday to gamble. Middlesbrough Bank, Charlton Pithead, Middlesbrough Bank, the town's Monte Carlo, Marketplace in Chesterfield, all these are sort of centres of mass-scale gambling, which the police turned a blind eye to, except for about four times in the year, to show them that they were doing their duty. The Home Office was also against gambling and gaming restrictions. Its real problem, we wanted gambling made legal. It also wanted gaming made legal. I've said it already, but in fact they had no end of time wasting their efforts of trying to decide whether partner whist was a chance or skill. What a waste of effort, I think was the suggestion. We've got that, I can cut some of that out, but that's the general lines of it. I'm going to say there's one example there. The Labour had us in the office of 29 to 31, J.R. Clines was the Home Secretary, and he has to try to enforce rules about raising money. Now, Ernest Bevin, Transport and General Workers Union, his union decided to go on the street to raise money for hospitals. It's illegal. You go out on the streets to get the public. You advertise it as well. And I love this beautiful phrase, J.R. Clines, you know, J.R. Clines had a very weedy voice. He goes, I'm not scared of Ernest, you know, I'm going to tell him to stop it. He doesn't. Because, you know, you take act against the biggest union in the country or the most powerful union in the country, you could bring the country to a halt. You know, it's nonsense. You know, you can't even raise money for hospitals because of the law as it stands. Well, moving to the third question, why did it take so long for gambling to be, the rules against working class gambling, of course, to be changed? Now, I've probably put five or six factors there, and I'll choose two or three. I think one important thing is the representatives of the working class, the rising and emerging Labour Party. And I think I've hinted at it already, the Parliamentary Labour Party was, in its early days, very much non-conformist. Not James Ramsay MacDonald was a non-conformist. Keir Hardie was, the Unitarian, Keir Hardie. And really, in a sense, these people were committed to, you know, getting rid of gambling. George Lansbury was the same. George Lansbury, the grandfather of Angela Lansbury, one time leader of the Labour Party, he was the same. There's a beautiful comment in the House of Commons. In 1930, there was an attempt by Jack O'Davison to have a lottery set up to help hospitals in this country. He was defeated. And most of the people defeated it were Labour MPs. A year later, he puts it forward again. The Labour Party has been defeated with a crisis of 31 lost seats. And he says this, and I think, I will not say that their departure was entirely due to their opposition to my bill, laughter in the House, but it contributed, obviously, the collapse of their government and accounted for Labour's decline. And he argued that, well, it's taken the mickey, but in fact, really, their opposition to gambling measures, or a part of gambling, was responsible for that. But if you look later on, George Thomas, remember Speaker of the House? Every time he ever voted, before he was Speaker, he voted against any gambling measure. Clare Mackley, sometime leader of the Labour Party, Prime Minister, voted against. If you were a Greyhound man, you'd be very upset by Attlee, because he introduced taxes in 1946-47, because he thought he was interfering with industrial production. So let's, you know, stop that. So the Labour Party is one factor. There are other factors such as taxing that. But can I come on to the major point, I think, is that is in the 20s, three developments occurred, all of which exposed the working class to more legal gambling opportunities. There was a reaction against it. One was the Irish sweepstake lottery, begun in November 1930. By Richard Duggan, a Dublin bookmaker. And by 1931, it had 4 sweep state draws had been drawn, 10 million, 9 to 10 million quid. I think the many British people were doing it. The first draw was in the Plaza Cinema, Dublin, and Irish nurses turned the draw barrel from which a blind boy pulled out the number. And it was presided over by General Duffy, the Commissioner of Police. So that was the tickets were 10 shilling each, and the first event was the Manchester November Handicap, but later on it was made out of Grand National. In Britain, that's illegal. Most of the money comes from Britain. So what do the police have to do? They have to interfere with people sending letters across and see if they're sent. If they send money with it, they're in trouble. If there's no money, they can't be had, you know, buying tickets. Now that worried, you can't believe the flurry that went out in the Home Office and other sections to deal with that. The working class, if that's illegal. But there's a second thing, football pools. You know, the football pools emerged before the First World War. In the 20s, they burgeoned. And you might remember George Orwell, The Road to William Pier, talked about the football pools being suspended because there were a Methodistic charge to the Football Association who said, you cannot publish our pools. And they lasted 2 weeks. What they said is that you can't publish the pools until Friday night for the match on a Saturday, so the football pools couldn't operate. Well, the trouble is, of course, Football teams didn't know whether they were going to play on a Saturday until play Friday night. It lasted 2 weeks. But the whole of Yorkshire was in turmoil. Damn the Spanish Civil War. Yeah, the importance of the mission was here. And football pools developed very rapidly. 100 companies by the late 20s. Littlewoods, obviously. Vernon, some chap called Lewis and Littlewood, formed Littlewoods. After the year, Littlewood said he would never make money, so he left. And of course, the name was left behind. But Mr. Lewis, or in his family, made a lot of money. And there's Vernon's, the Strangers, the Strands, the Scopes, the Soccer Pools, the Shermans, the Setters, the Western Pools, the Gamarca, you could shop at Gamarca and put football pools on that in Leeds, etc. And of course, you know, the church, particularly the church groups, the anti-gambling league, were horrified by this. But the third and the major one, and of course the pool got round in fat credit, you could pay the second week, as I mentioned at the beginning. So it became credit gambling, so it's legal. And the major one is greyhound racing. This is the shock waves go through. The first attempt at greyhound racing was in 1876, and it failed. Then in Oklahoma City, about 1924-25, I'd like to do something on Oklahoma City because it's where parking meters started and everything else. All my interest in Oklahoma City, that's another matter. But going back, in 1926, as a result of this, Bellevue started. By 4 or 5 years down the line, there are 220 licenses for race tracks, greyhound tracks, and 180 tracks in existence. That's without things like flapping tracks and illegal tracks. I mean, only 30 years ago, about 30 years ago, I was in a pub just outside Lancaster Jail, or Lancaster Castle was in the jail. I went to this pub, they had a lot of dogs under the table. And she even under the shirts and things. And suddenly when they accepted it was all right, but they were going to do an illegal, just below the castle, an illegal flapping track. Yeah, unbelievable. There were other tracks. In 1934, you couldn't actually, to get around some of the restrictions, you could actually have a piece of land and run it, track it for 8 days. But wise people used to divide it into 8 pieces and be able to run dog races for 64 days. There's all sorts of things. They did develop, and you've suddenly got 38, 40 million attendances. The vast majority are regulars. There's some 200,000 people, middle working class people, right, attendees on a regular basis. But you're suddenly getting 20,000 and 30,000 people. Bellevue, that's 200 bookies apart from the toad. It's a shock. And this is what the government say. This is a government report, happened, reported in the House of Commons. This is for the metropolitan area of London. There are only 7 race courses within 50 miles of Charing Cross. That means the metropolitan police area of London. With 187 days of racing, horse racing. Whereas in the same area there are 23 greyhound tracks with over 4,000 days of racing within a year. Grade round racing has brought on-course betting facilities, often and almost a nightly event, into most large urban centres of the country. The working class can vote, sorry, not vote, they can gamble legally. Now that's the shock. And of course, they're horrified when these tracks provide facilities that the women and children go on. 30%, according to one report in 1927, are women and girls. They have kindergartens. The Tartan track in Glasgow, a kindergarten. Well, this fulfills all the concerns of the National Anti-Gambling League I mentioned at the beginning. Now, above all, of course, they're concerned about the money, so, because these people set up tubs. You get a manager to manage the track, because the manager can't run a tub, but the owners can set up a tub. And they can take 10-12% off before they're restricted to 6%. And in 1931, this is the government report here. One track, the White City in Manchester, declared a dividend of £212,000. One man had invested £100 and had been paid £6,000 a year ever since. Another guaranteed the company at the bank for a few £1,000 and has drawn £7,000 ever since. These fellows ought to be on the means test to know the meaning of poverty. King Solomon's mines cannot compare with the money that is being raked out of greyhound racing. And yet these people, racecourse owners, tell us that they are clean, honest and fair, as in any other sport. Well, the government was horrified at this, and did impose restrictions. John Buchan, if you remember, the 39 steps, etc., was it Lord Tweed Law later on or something like that, tried to stop greyhound racing by giving powers to local authorities to stop them, and referred to them as illuminated ribbons of turf. Well, they evidently haven't been to Welsh greyhound meetings, because they're not illuminated ribbons of turf, they're illuminated ribbons of ash. Winston Churchill referred to them as animated roulette boards. He didn't like them. But they were successful in stopping them, etc. Their concern was, as Winston Churchill said, the practically eliminated facilities of the working class to continuously gamble. And that's what he disliked. Now, the next question, in a sense, is the government continued to introduce controls, but the democratic society, you cannot go against the will of the end. In 1918, the franchise was extended. In 1928, it was extended further. In 1948, we got rid of double voting, you know, that you could go to Bradford one day and vote there and vote another chicken the next. That sort of property vote. In 1949-51, the Willard Commission on Gambling and Gaming advised the need to license street betting, to make it legal, effectively. There was a strong move against it, but that was the case. Also things like gaming, bingo, and things I haven't really talked about. Increasingly, political parties found that they were raising their money by that. Labour, Federalist agents, not 60 other Leeds agents, by 1952 were paid by Little Bingo or Tombola Sessions. The Conservative Party, 1,500 clubs raised their money by Tombola Sessions. And it was pointed out, it's actually for money. And it's illegal. So everybody felt that they had to do something about changing the laws and regulating it. There was a full attempt at it in 1955-56, when in fact everything got confused and wrong. Bob Booth, does anybody remember Bob Booth?
Yeah.
Bob Booth, I remember the Brains Trust, he was a advisor to Macmillan, controllers on Macmillan, all sorts of things. Macmillan's wife, exactly. He was a cuckold. That's an old phrase. In fact, I remember he, at the age of 80, he married a young lady of about 21, didn't he? And he lasted about a year. Anyway, that's another story. In November 1955, so confused with the law, Bob Booth reported to the House of Commons that he, the Lord Chief Justice, the Speaker of the House, and others, had gone to Bognor Regis the previous weekend. They had seen Bingham playing it night and day. Now they discovered that it was illegal, and that it might be before the week on Monday. Now he's taking the miracle, but you know, he's pointing out the hypocrisy and the stupidity of the law. In conclusion, I really want to bring the threads together. I've said the answer, really, in a sense. First of all, that gambling was a small-scale activity, by and large, manageable within the working class budget up to the 1960s. Secondly, the restriction money comes from a relatively small base, but powerful base of nonconformists and church opinion. Thirdly, the police and others really did not feel that controlling working class gambling was worth the trouble. It might be immoral, but you know, the middle class can do it. Why the hell can't the working class? And they recognise it as a piece of class legislation. And fourthly, at the end, after 50 years, it was removed because, really, in a sense, as Harold Macmillan said in 1960, he said, let's get rid of this mess. He said, you know, you cannot bat against the tide of public opinion. And in 1960, an act was passed, which in 1961, from April 61, set up betting houses, licensed betting facilities. It's a sad day for me because it put me out of the shop. Finish there.